bracing herself for the extra weight. He did as he was told, and she didn't have to tell him what to do next. In seconds, he'd managed to pull himself up to her waist, and she released one hand from the tree in order to reach down and grip his arm, helping him struggle up until his butt was on the bank. Then, finally, she released her grip on the tree that had thankfully stood its ground and rose to hook her arms under his armpits and pull him further onto the bank, safely away from the raging stream. He groaned out a curse as she stopped to try and catch her breath, his head back on the ground and his hands clenched into fists. She stared down at him, noting the wild look in his blue eyes. They looked unnaturally blue against the pasty white color of his nearly frozen flesh.
"Thank you,"
he muttered, and then it looked like he attempted to sit up. But agony passed through his expression as he fell back unconscious.
"Great," Amanda muttered.
She turned to look back at the house. Her barn was almost completely engulfed, but it appeared that the fire was staying confined to the structure itself. Even the nearby fencing hadn't caught. There must have been enough rain to keep it and the surrounding land just damp enough for safety's sake. Good enough. It was too late to do anything about her barn or her plane. The priority was getting this man back to her place to assess his injuries and call for help. The boonies were no place for a life-threatening illness or injury. Amanda plopped down beside him, checking him over for any serious, obvious injuries. He'd said his leg was broken, but she was worried about a head injury or internal injuries. Possible hypothermia was also a problem, but it hadn't set in yet. It would probably become the priority if it did, but she thought they were out of the woods now that he was on dry land. Taking stock of him, her eyes roamed over the tattoos covering both his arms. She knew better than to judge a book by its cover and ignored the newly uncovered tats, and she lifted his soaked T-shirt, looking for any wounds or bruising that would indicate internal bleeding. She couldn't help but notice he was in good shape. She guessed him to be late 30s, maybe his early 40s, and athletic. There was a deep gash over his rib cage that would need to be cleaned and stitched, she guessed, along with what was the start of some bruising that could indicate a broken rib or two, but no signs of internal injuries. And yes, she agreed that his leg was broken when she took another look at the angle it had come to rest at, or rather, angles. There was no way to tell how he'd come to be in the stream, and she had no idea if his injuries were the result of an accident or being tossed around in the churning water. But it didn't matter at the moment. Her fingers moved into his thick black hair, gently checking his scalp for lacerations, and finding none. She did feel a large bump on the side of his head. A concussion, then. She looked between him and the house, then glanced at her crumbling barn again, before looking back to the stranger.
"Well, crap," she murmured,
the full weight of the last 10 minutes of her life slamming into her. 4. Austin blinked several times, staring up at the orange-streaked sky. His head was pounding, and he was cold, really cold, and wet. His left leg throbbed distractingly, and he felt as if he'd just been through the rinse cycle in a washing machine. His hand reached up to touch his forehead, feeling out a prominent bump beneath his hair. "You're awake?" a woman's voice said, startling him. He rolled his head to the side and saw a woman walking towards him.
"You?"
He swallowed the dry word that would have come next, thinking he'd sounded like a frog just then, and tried again.
You're the one who pulled me out of the water.
She smiled. It's generally a nice tranquil stream, but you happen to go for a swim when it's swollen and violent. It only feels like a river right now because of the spring runoff.
Oh, he muttered, trying to orientate himself. But I fell into a river.
She grimaced above him, and then crouched down to meet his eyes. You're lucky to be alive, then. This stream branches off from the river more than a mile from here. And if it looks like this, I can only imagine what the river's like right now.
It's cold, too, he grunted.
She half smiled at the joke, and he looked back to the sky. It was still light out, but barely. He was guessing it was around 9. He needed to get back to the trailer and let Savannah know he was okay. First, though, he needed a hospital. He was convinced his leg was broken. I brought a pair of crutches, she said, brandishing a pair of metal ones. He stared at them for a moment, wondering if she was serious.
For me?
I can't carry you, she told him. I thought about making a stretcher out of a blanket if I couldn't get you up, but that was my last resort, she muttered. He sat up, jarring his leg and wincing with pain when he moved it.
I think it's broken.
You said that already, she replied dryly. She squatted in front of him again. She was pretty, was his first thought. She had shoulder-length black hair, soaked and sticking to her olive skin around her face and neck. Her wet T-shirt clung to her body, showing off her trim figure. And he knew he shouldn't look, but she was an attractive woman, and he wasn't blind. A little broken, but definitely not blind.
I'm sorry, my head is a little foggy. Can you take me to the hospital? He asked.
I tried calling for help, but my cell is dead and the power's out. That's why I brought the crutches. I think they're about our only option, though I'm going to go get my truck now that you're awake, she added.
We'll make it work then, he acknowledged, still wondering how he'd stand on the crutches. Sorry to be a bother, he muttered.
It's fine. The hospital's about 20 minutes away. Sit tight and I'll bring my truck closer, she said, standing and jogging away, leaving the crutches beside him. He bent his good leg and tried to get to a standing position, but it wasn't going to happen. He'd just have to wait for his savior to come back. The sky seemed to be getting darker by the minute, but he kept his eyes on the rushing water a few yards in front of him and shook his head. The woman was right that he was lucky to have escaped that water with his life. Someone had tried to kill him. Callum was dead. It felt surreal. He was a boring fluff journalist. Stuff like this didn't happen to him. Her footsteps behind him were what grabbed his attention. Her truck had to have the quietest engine he'd ever heard. He hadn't heard a thing.
I'm going to need some help up, he confessed without looking at her, a little embarrassed to be so helpless.
It wasn't something he was used to. Well, bad news. My truck won't start, she said, halting beside him with a bewildered look on her face.
Your truck won't start, he echoed.
First the power, and her phone, and now her truck? Who was this lady? Nope. Dead. Nothing turns on. I drove it a couple hours ago, and it was fine, she added, apparently reading the judgment on his face. I don't know what's wrong with it.
Is the battery dead?
I don't see how. It's a new truck. The battery should be fairly new. He closed his eyes.
Okay, so no power, no phone, and no truck. How far are we from town?
It's about 20 miles to Irvin. That's the closest hospital.
What?
He asked, his head jerking back to look up at her. She shrugged a shoulder.
That's the closest real town. They have a small hospital. Holy crap. I fell into the river north of Stanton, he said, shaking his head. She let out a low whistle. That's 40 miles away. 40 miles! He practically shouted. Look, you have to help me get back there. My daughter... She frowned deeper now. I'm sorry. I don't know how to get you there right now. But first things first, okay? We need to get you back up to the house so we can start warming you up. Austin swallowed down the panic in his gut, and then her words struck home. He didn't feel cold anymore, and that was a dangerous sign. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath, trying to pull his wits about him. I'm Austin. Austin Merriman. Thank you for saving me. Please don't think I'm ungrateful. I am. It's just... I really need to get home. She squatted in front of him. Austin, I'm Amanda Patterson. I'm a veterinarian and can take care of your leg until we figure out a hospital trip. I have some painkillers back at the house, but first we need to check you out and make sure you don't have any other injuries. Let's take care of the most pressing matters first. I need to get out of these wet clothes I'm wearing as well. I hit my head, he said, the throbbing reminding him of the rock he'd slammed into seconds after he'd hit the water. Austin, I'm going to help you stand up, and then you'll need to use the crutches to support the majority of your weight. Can you do that? She asked, her voice calm, clinical. It grounded him, as he imagined she'd meant it to, and he nodded. Yes. Okay. Put the crutch under your right arm. I'm going to lift you from behind, she instructed, moving behind him. You're not going to be able to lift me, he grumbled. I got you out of the stream, she shot back. She made a good point. With her help, he managed to get to his feet. Foot. He swayed a little, blinking several times to try and right the suddenly spinning world. I need a second, he muttered, his hands gripping the crutches. He inhaled through his nose, breathing through the pain rocketing through his body. The wave of dizziness made him sway on his one good leg, so that he appreciated her hand catching his elbow for support. Take a minute. Breathe slow and deep, and we'll move when you're ready, she said, her hand on his back, its warmth coming through the soaked shirt. Beside him, she was even shorter than he'd realized, maybe a few inches past 5 feet. She was right that he'd have to get to her house mostly on his own foot and the crutches. I'm ready, he said, taking a first shaky step forward. By the time he managed to make it up the 3 steps onto the covered front porch of her home, he was exhausted. He had 0 strength left. Ahead of him, she opened the screen door and gestured for him to go inside. Have a seat on the couch, she ordered him, lighting some candles near the door so that he could see. He hobbled over on the crutches before he collapsed onto her couch, grimacing in pain as the action jerked his leg once again. I'll be right back, she promised, heading out of the living room. He let the crutches fall against the couch beside him and squeezed his eyes closed, pain threatening to pull him under. When he'd managed to swallow it down and get past it, he opened his eyes and looked around the farmhouse. It looked cozy, with a plaid throw tossed over the back of a recliner and a small flat-screen TV on a plain stand. It was simple, very much like other farmhouses he'd seen and been in. When Amanda returned with more candles, she wore dry clothes herself and didn't waste any time before ordering him to take off his shirt. He leaned forward, struggling to pull his soaked T-shirt off. It was only with her help that he managed. She immediately covered him with a warm blanket, tucking it in around his neck. Pants, she told him flatly. He grimaced. Really? Your leg is broken, right? He nodded. Your pants are wet, right? He nodded again. Then strip, Austin. You're covered with a blanket, and I promise not to peek, she added, a cheeky grin flaring up on her face. Thank you, he told her, struggling to get his frozen fingers to work to undo his belt buckle. There was no way he was asking her for help with this. He managed to get the pants halfway down his thighs before she had to take over, working at the soaked shoelaces of his boot before gently pulling the pants down over his injured leg. It still hurt like hell. I need to clean the cut on your side before we deal with this leg, she said next, ignoring the fact that he was essentially naked under the blanket. Austin nodded yet again. What else could he do? Okay. I might need to stitch it closed, since I'm really not sure how to get you to the hospital, she said, the last words coming more hesitantly. His eyes popped open. What? That bad? I mean, I would have preferred we wait, but we can't wait too long, she advised him. Why? He asked. She shrugged. Her eyes squinted in thought. Even in the candlelight, he could tell she was concerned. It isn't bleeding, she answered, which is a good sign, but I don't want to risk an infection. The sooner we close it, the lower the risk of an infection. You have about 12 hours after an injury to stitch it, she explained. 12 hours wasn't much time when they didn't have an immediate plan. That does it, then. Stitch it. Are you sure? She pressed. He stared up at her. You said you were a vet, right? You know what you're doing? He asked. I do. I'm guessing you might need 8 to 10 stitches. I have a numbing agent that will help, she said, holding up a bottle. Do whatever. I need to get home. My daughter, she'll be there alone wondering what happened to me. Amanda gently sat down on the couch beside him, clearly trying not to shift the cushion below his injured leg as he maneuvered the blanket away from his side. What did happen to you? She asked, dumping a clear liquid on a gauze pad before she pressed it against the injury that he'd barely even realized was there. He blamed the frigid temperatures for numbing his body, which was a small blessing. He imagined he'd be very stiff and sore tomorrow, not to mention covered in bruises. I fell off a bridge, he lied. She raised an eyebrow. You should learn to be more careful. I'll keep that in mind. She smiled tightly and held the gauze to his side as she pulled a candle positioned on the table behind the couch closer. Ready? She asked. He nodded and expected real pain when she put a needle to his skin. But there was only a pinch before he felt tugging and some stinging as she continued. Maybe, along with the cold, the numbing agent had truly helped dull the sharp pain he knew he should be feeling. If anything, the stitching hurt just less than getting a tattoo. As he watched her tediously pull the black thread through his skin, he remembered the pain he'd felt in his side when the bullets had started to fly. That was it. He'd been grazed by a bullet and hadn't even realized it in the moment. He wasn't about to tell this woman he'd been shot at, though. Finished with his side, she pronounced his break a simple one and used a horse splint to brace his broken leg before using some hot pink vet wrap to keep it in place. The support of the brace provided almost immediate relief. He could already feel the muscles in his leg relaxing a bit. Sorry about the pink. It's all I had on hand, she said with a grin. We'll do a real cast tomorrow if we can't figure out how to get you to the hospital. I took care of a dog's broken leg just last week, she said, as if to make him feel better. So, if you can handle the color, we'll be okay. He shrugged, thinking he was at least beyond lucky that he'd landed in a vet's hands rather than the average farmer's. My masculinity can handle a pink cast if it comes to it.
Good. Now, I have a camp stove. I'm going to fire it up and make us some hot soup, she said, taking off the latex gloves she'd been wearing. I'll light some more candles as well.
I really need to get home, he reminded her tiredly.
Austin, I understand you need to get back to your daughter, but I honestly don't know how to get you there. Not tonight. Tomorrow I can get to a neighbor and see about help. The closest farm's a few miles down the road.
He took a deep breath. That's right. No phones or power. Even my plane died, she muttered under her breath.
For a moment he thought he'd imagined her words, but then she nodded when he repeated,
Your plane died?
And the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. She ran a hand through her thick black hair.
Yeah. One second I'm up in the sky doing my thing, and the next my gauges fell flat.
You were in the air? He asked, searching for obvious signs that she'd survived a plane crash and finding none.
I was, for about 2 minutes, before I slammed into the barn and basically fell to the ground, she said on a small laugh.
Are you okay?
Yep, little cut on my hand.
Can't say the same for my barn, though.
He leaned his head back against the couch as she walked away, trying to put all the pieces together. In his head, he was creating a timeline, like he would have if he'd been writing a story. The timeline and the facts that he knew for sure. His brain kept coming back to one thing. It couldn't be that, however. That was not possible. He wouldn't let himself suspect it.
Here, she said, coming back into the living room. Take these.
What are they? He asked, taking the small white pills from her palm.
They're antibiotics. With that gash on your side and the crap that was in that stream, you need to get started on antibiotics right away.
He popped them into his mouth and swallowed them down with the bottle of water she handed him.
You said you're a vet. These were meant for animals?
She grinned. People, dogs, horses, all the same.
He'd have to take her word for it.
Tell me something. Do you have a computer?
I live in the country, not the Dark Ages.
Does it turn on? He asked, ignoring her joke.
I'll check.
With that, she disappeared for a few seconds, and then came back with a newish-looking laptop in her hand.
Does it turn on? He asked, when she seemed to be struggling with it.
Amanda looked up at him, meeting his eyes now.
No.
How did you know?
He ran a hand down his face, feeling the scruff on his jaw.
It's just a suspicion. Your phone, is it completely dead?
She nodded.
Black screen.
He bit back a curse.
Radio. Do you have a radio?
He asked, looking around her living room.
She disappeared and returned with an old-school battery-powered radio.
It's dead. I thought the batteries were good, but maybe not.
Great, he mumbled, his mind whirring as he put together the pieces of the puzzle in front of him. His brain was a little jumbled after being slammed into a rock and then frozen, and he wanted to think he was wrong anyway.
What is your suspicion?
She asked, settling into the nearby armchair.
He felt a little ridiculous saying it, but maybe he needed to say it aloud and then process it.
I don't know. I'm trying to put all the pieces together. This seems a little too science fiction to believe.
What's too sci-fi?
He looked away from her.
I don't know, like, it's like something knocked out the power grid.
She stared at him, A downed power grid wouldn't kill the electronics in my house or my truck, she whispered. He looked her in the eye then, finally ready to sound like a nut job. Have you ever heard of something called an EMP? That's what I'm starting to wonder about. Her eyebrows shot up. EMP? An electromagnetic pulse? You know about them? She nodded as she leaned back, still staring at him. I do. I was in the Air Force for a few years, in the cybersecurity department. I know a lot about them. What do you think? Is it a possibility? He asked, wanting to know he wasn't crazy. Or, really, maybe hoping he was. She looked thoughtful. You know, I think it is. Wow, how crazy is that? She asked softly. If it was an EMP, this whole area is going to be in a blackout, he said, fear for his daughter mounting. She covered her mouth with one of her small hands. Oh my God, I didn't think it would actually happen. Maybe it wasn't that. It could be... She stopped talking. He waited, hoping she'd offer a better suggestion. Austin was only vaguely familiar with what an EMP was, and remembered it being explained as frying the computers and electrical components in just about everything in the vicinity of such a pulse. He'd been treated to that explanation, and a lot of hypotheses about how far-reaching damage might be by the preppers he'd met about 6 months before. They'd gone to great lengths to prepare for an EMP, and had not only stockpiled food and water, but put radios and other electrical equipment in Faraday cages. He hadn't thought they were crazy, but he had thought they were preparing for a one-in-a-million disaster, and would have been better off putting their money elsewhere. Now it seemed they'd been the smart ones. I have a feeling you aren't the only one who didn't think it would happen, he muttered. I have to get out of here. I've got to get to my daughter. Forget the hospital. If this is an EMP, there's no point. I can't leave Savannah alone. I have to go, he said, sitting up again and reaching for a crutch. Austin, you can't. Not right now. Amanda leaned forward, putting her hand on his arm to freeze him. How old is your daughter? 14. Okay, so she's not a little kid. She'll go home and wait for you. We'll find a way in the morning. It's going to be pitch black out there, she said, in that familiar, calm voice. He looked out the living room windows. Night had fallen, and without the benefit of headlights or a flashlight, navigating the dark terrain would be dangerous. He couldn't risk another injury. A lump formed in his throat. You're right. Good. Settle back down and I'll get us some soup. You need to rest. I'll check on my horses, and then I'll keep an eye on you throughout the night. You might have a mild concussion. Thank you. She shrugged, her expression serious. I think we're in this together now. So, soup. Then I'll take care of my horses and you'll rest. I need to make sure that fire's out, too. But it was supposed to rain tonight, and it seemed to be dying earlier, so that shouldn't take long. I'm sorry. I wish I could help, he said, feeling a little useless. Rest, Austin. That's what you need, she said, sounding confident everything would be okay. And if you're sure you want to find your daughter and forgo a hospital, though honestly I'm not sure how we'd get you there, or what they could do that I couldn't if our guess is right, then I'll put a cast on that leg of yours first thing in the morning. Yeah, he acknowledged. That might be best. He watched her force a smile before she left the room. He nodded to himself, trying to accept the way things had changed in just a few hours, and the state he was in on this couch. Okay, then. I'll be right here, he said belatedly. 5. Savannah sat at one of the picnic tables, watching the Loveridge family as they hugged one another, cried, and did their best to come to terms with the death of the family patriarch. One of the members of their revival group had covered Eli with a white sheet, but he was still lying in the same spot. Everyone had held hands around the body, while Jim Loveridge had said a prayer. Savannah had held Malachi's hand, but the close contact had been nothing like earlier. After the prayers and a song, everyone had drifted away from the body and the Loveridge family, and Savannah had found herself retreating to sit nearby and observe. She didn't want to drag Malachi away from his family sooner than she had to, and she knew he wouldn't let her walk home alone. Some of the people who'd traveled a long way to come to the revival were still hanging around, and she knew exactly how they felt. She also felt kind of stuck. Her home on wheels was probably only a couple of miles away, but it was dark and quiet, and the night had unnerved her. She'd told herself that Malachi wouldn't let her walk home alone, and she thought that was the case. But she also didn't want him to. Her eyes scanned the area again. She felt like an outsider, an interloper. She needed to leave and let them be alone. The other people left were lingering on the other side of the clearing, huddled in small groups and talking in harsh whispers, gesturing wildly. Savannah didn't know them at all. She wasn't a Loveridge, but she wasn't one of them either, panicking over cars or cell phones. After Eli's death, it had become clear that none of the vehicles would work. A few families had gathered purses and other belongings from their vehicles and set out walking. They were long gone now, and Savannah was left thinking about her dad and wondering where he was. Was he back at the trailer, or had he been stranded somewhere as well? Would he come looking for her? He would, if he could, she knew. And a new pang of regret shot through her over the fact that she'd lied to him about where she'd really planned on coming that night. He wouldn't know where to look for her if he tried. Feeling invisible, she eavesdropped on the many conversations happening around her. One of the people who'd been at the revival mentioned something about a government shutdown. Someone else claimed it was an enemy attack and World War III had just been started. Savannah didn't know about all that. But something big and something very terrible had happened for everything to have shut down like this. Her gaze moved back to the Loveridge family silhouetted in the glow of candles and lanterns that had been gathered. If the situation hadn't been so awful, it would have been beautiful out here in the country with no light pollution. She was glad this family had each other at last. When her mom had died, it had been just her and her father in the hospital room. She would never forget how it had felt to leave the hospital without her mother. Now, it was only her and her dad. No one else. Malachi still had a full family to care for him, regardless of the tragedy they'd just suffered. Just then, he looked over at her and smiled. She smiled back, giving him a small wave. He said something to his mom before giving her a quick kiss on the cheek and making his way towards the table where Savannah sat. He perched on the bench beside her, his eyes on the ground in front of him, and his hands resting in his lap. She could feel the grief rolling off of him, and almost moved away to give him more space. Her own grief over her mother was still raw. Feeling his made it hard to keep her own in check. As the night had gotten calmer, her own emotions had been bubbling over with memories. sorry to have left you alone, he told her.
No, don't be sorry. I'm fine. Your family needs you.
My mom is pretty upset, he said quietly. He was so healthy, so happy.
I'm so sorry about your grandpa, Malachi. Really.
Thanks. It's terrible, and I'm really going to miss him, he said, choking on a sob before regaining his composure. He was a friend. She gave him another minute and then made her decision.
I should get going. Your family needs time alone.
His face shot up, and he focused on her for the first time since coming to the table.
It's dark, Savannah. You can't walk home alone, he replied, his voice strained. I'll be okay. Stay here. Help your mom.
Did anyone get a hold of emergency services? She asked.
No. I have no idea what's happened, but no phones work. None of the cars will start, and Dad can't get any of the generators to run again. I think that's what killed my grandpa.
She stared at him, trying to catch up with the change in topic.
What killed him? She asked. He had a pacemaker. It's like everything electrical just stopped working, including his pacemaker. He was so healthy, that has to be it.
Oh. Wow. I'm so sorry, Malachi. That's just awful, she said, putting her hand over his.
Did you hear that one guy talking? He thinks the power grids were all shut down, Malachi added, looking at her.
I did hear him say that, she replied, not wanting to add any more stress. She'd been hoping the people talking about war were overreacting, and that everything would be back to normal in a few hours, by the time she got back to the RV, even.
I'll ask my mom if it's okay for me to walk you back, Malachi said as he rose from the bench.
And though Savannah felt like she should protest again, she didn't. He returned a minute later with permission to walk her home, and they slowly headed out of the revival area and back towards town. The moonlight and brilliant stars on the clear night were so pretty, and she felt freer now, leaving the campground behind and listening to the crickets beginning their night songs. With Malachi beside her, his hand occasionally brushing hers, she could almost forget how horribly things had gone wrong. If this was the beginning of a war, she knew she would never forget the exact moment it had happened and who she'd been with. Malachi had more than earned a strong place in her life story. She only hoped it was a long life story, and that it wouldn't be cut short by whatever it was that was happening. They'd been walking in silence, both lost to their own thoughts, when a gunshot rang out. Malachi and Savannah froze, looking at one another.
"What was that?" she whispered.
"Maybe someone is hunting in the forest," Malachi offered doubtfully.
"At night?"
he shrugged. "I don't know. Stay close." Malachi took her hand now, and they walked a little farther, neither of them talking as they moved. Her eyes darted left and right, trying to see through the trees lining the right side of the road. Everything looked shadowy, even in the field on the opposite side of the road from the trees. It was eerie, and she couldn't wait to get home. But she tried to tell herself that the creepiness of the night was all in her head. Talking would help break up the extreme quiet, but unfortunately Savannah had no idea what to say to the boy next to her. She knew he was hurting, but this wasn't something that a hug would help with. Her own personal experience told her clearly that no amount of hugs would make the pain go away. This was something he would have to deal with on his own, working through all the painful emotions that were sure to plague him over the next several days and coming weeks. They were on the very outskirts of the town, which was itself totally dark, when her thoughts were broken into again.
"Watch out!" Malachi shouted suddenly, grabbing her arm and yanking her to the left, as a man on a bike turned the corner of a building and nearly ran them over as he raced past.
"Oh my God, what was that about?" she shrieked.
Her answer appeared in the form of another man racing around the corner, a gun in his hand as he waved it around, shouting at the man on the bike.
"Stop! Stop or I'll shoot!" he screamed out as he shoved past them.
"We should go back," Malachi whispered, looking after the two men. "I've got to get home. My dad will be worried sick," she insisted. "Just walk me through town, please."
Malachi nodded, and they kept going, stopping only when they reached the gas station where she'd met him earlier.
"Whoa,"
Malachi gasped, staring at the broken windows of the storefront. The gas pump's hoses were lying limp on the ground with a car parked nearby. The whole place looked deserted.
"What happened?"
Savannah asked, walking towards the store.
"Savannah, wait, don't get too close," Malachi warned her, grabbing her arm to hold her back.
Instead, she pulled him along with her, drawn to the chaos. There was glass everywhere, with the door of the store partially ajar, hung up on a package of diapers on the ground. Something was horribly wrong, and Savannah kept moving inside the store. A scream tore from her throat when she saw the shop owner lying in the glass inside the store, dark liquid pooling under his head. There were broken beer bottles scattered around him, one just beside his open hand, as if he tried to use it as a weapon, and then dropped it upon falling.
"Let's get out of here," Malachi ordered her, grabbing her hand and pulling her away, dragging her down the road back towards the campground his family had set up. Savannah didn't argue, knowing that they were closer to his home than hers.
More gunshots sounded out as they raced out of the store, these coming from farther down the road, in town somewhere. A scream, followed by more gunshots, echoed around them as they raced back toward the trees.
"I need to go home," she cried, sliding to a halt.
Malachi held her hand tighter and tugged her into the trees.
"Tomorrow, Savannah. Listen to what's happening in town. We can't go back through there, not tonight."
Another gunshot put the exclamation point on his words, and she nodded, even though she could feel herself crying now. Without more needing to be said, Malachi began running again, her hand still in his as he pulled her along at a breakneck pace. By the time they burst into the open area where Malachi's family was carrying the body into the main tent, Savannah was completely out of breath and had a stitch in her side. She bent down to catch her breath as Malachi went to his parents, yelling to get their attention. Everyone stopped and turned to look at him.
"What's wrong?"
Malachi's mother demanded. He shook his head, his eyes wide as he looked back and forth between Savannah and his family, shock suddenly getting to him.
"Shooting. In town. Mom, someone shot the store owner. We found him and the store was deserted."
Malachi stared between his parents, apparently waiting for some reaction, but everyone had gone statue still.
"We ran back here," Savannah explained, stepping in beside Malachi. "We kept hearing gunshots as we ran."
"I think the town is under attack, Dad. There was screaming and so much gunfire."
Malachi's father rushed forward at that, wrapping his arms around his son.
"It's okay. God will protect us."
"Dad, something really bad is happening," Malachi said, his voice raspy.
Savannah hugged herself, wishing her dad was there with them. Now that the adrenaline was wearing off, she felt terrified. What was happening? "The world's gone mad,"
Jim Loveridge said, as if answering her question. But it was the same question she saw on everyone's faces. Everyone's but his, really. This is what we've been preaching about. This is what we've been trying to warn people about, he continued, stepping back with his hands on Malachi's shoulders as he looked into his son's eyes. One of the men who traveled with the family dropped to his knees and began to pray outside the tent. Another one followed suit. Jim turned to look at them, praising them for turning to God in their time of need, and Savannah took advantage of the moment to step up beside Malachi.
"What is he talking about?"
Savannah asked in a hushed voice.
"It's the end times," he said,
his eyes going wide with what almost looked like excitement.
"What?"
she asked.
"This can't be happening. This is a nightmare, not real life."
Before she could give voice to her thoughts, however, Jim Loveridge walked towards her, took her hands in his, and smiled. This was predicted in the Bible. "Society will fall," he told her calmly. "Chaos will ensue. It's time for us to go home."
"What do you mean, society will fall?"
Savannah asked, looking beyond him to Malachi. He seemed so normal. But this wasn't normal. Famine, food shortages, lawlessness. "It's all raining down upon us," Jim Loveridge said, looking up at the sky. Savannah felt a sudden rush of doubt and fear. It was time for her to go. She didn't know these people all that well, and they seemed a little too excited about impending doom. If it was what they were predicting, she wanted to be with her dad. The last thing she wanted was to be with a group of strangers who seemed excited about the idea of the Bible predicting chaos.
"I need to go home," she whispered.
"No, you can't. It isn't safe," Jim said, a little too loudly. He looked at his wife, and Savannah saw the woman was nodding, her mouth set in a firm line.
"But my dad..." "We'll take you home in the morning, when it's daylight,"
Malachi's mother said firmly. Her husband agreed. "Tonight, we pack up. We'll set out on foot tomorrow." Savannah looked between them and Malachi, who seemed stunned.
"Where will you go?"
she asked. "Home," Jim replied simply.
"Where's home?"
"Salt Lake City," Malachi answered. "That's where I was born."
"You're going to walk to Salt Lake City?" she asked incredulously.
Jim smiled. "It's the only way.
We'll escort you back to your father in the morning."
She shook her head, unable to process the thought of walking that far.
"Thank you,"
she muttered, not happy to be stuck overnight, but not exactly looking forward to walking through the town, where it did appear that people had lost their minds. Hopefully, her father would understand her being out overnight. Maybe he wouldn't even be back till morning himself, she reminded herself, if he'd also gotten stuck somewhere because of that meeting he'd headed off to. "Thank you for trying to help out earlier," Jim said, motioning toward where Eli lay. Savannah nodded, trying not to look at the covered body.
"I'm so sorry for your family's loss."
"God has a plan. We can't know that plan, but we can accept it," he said, his tone weirdly serene. Savannah nodded again. She couldn't have been so calm about it, but knew some people felt that way. Everyone had to deal with a loss of loved ones in their own way.
"Thank you for letting me stay," Savannah said, with a smile she didn't feel.
"Of course. Malachi, take her over to the trailer and talk with Gretchen.
She'll get her set up with a cot in the kitchen tent, Jim said. Immediately, Malachi took Savannah's hand and turned to face her. I'm sorry I couldn't get you home. I know you must be worried about your dad. It's okay, she said, her voice going tight. Your family is probably right. It isn't safe out there right now. He ushered her away from his family, back toward the smaller tent. We set up cots in the kitchen tent area after everyone goes home. We keep extra on hand, in case anyone needs a place to stay for the night, he explained. Does that happen often? She asked. He let out a long sigh. It does. My family has fed and sheltered many homeless people during our travels. We tend to collect people, as my mother would say. Gretchen is one of them, like her boyfriend, Tim. They might as well be family in a lot of ways. That's amazing. Your family is so generous, she told him, some of her doubt from earlier draining away with a reminder of how kind-hearted this family seemed to be. Thank you. We like to do it. Malachi, the farm we're staying at, Savannah began, thinking of it only now. They have a lot of horses, and even a few donkeys. Maybe the owner would be willing to let your family have a couple? You have so far to go. Wouldn't it be nice to have a couple horses? Malachi stopped walking. She could barely see his face in the dark shadows of the trees they were now standing in, but she sensed his excitement when he squeezed her hand. That would be amazing. Maybe we can find a cart or a wagon like they used in the old days. I know I saw one in someone's yard on the other side of town, he said. Savannah smiled, happy enough just to have brought him some joy on such a horrible night. 6. Savannah couldn't help feeling anxious as she walked with Malachi a few feet in front of his parents in the bright morning light. She'd wanted to run home to see her father as soon as the sun had come up, and did even now. But the revivalists had taken their sweet time packing things they wanted to take with them. Eli had been buried the night before while she'd slept, and so the morning had been dedicated to planning. They'd talked about taking down the tents, but Jim had decided to leave them up for anyone seeking shelter. The tents were far too big and cumbersome to carry home, he'd pointed out. After what had felt like forever, once they had packed up as much as they could carry, the group of 10 or so people had finally set off for the farm where Savannah had been staying with her father. Are you sure you're going to walk all that way? Savannah whispered. We have to. We can't stay here and live in a tent, he replied. But you've been living in tents, she pointed out. Reasonably, she thought. Malachi laughed. No, we've had our motor homes, with water and electricity and beds. We haven't actually been living in the tents. What if it isn't what your dad said? What if this is some kind of freak accident and things will be back to normal in a day or two? She questioned, still not ready to believe the world was ending. Then you'll have to walk back here to retrieve everything. And truly, even the way Malachi's family was acting didn't seem all that real. She'd certainly seen her fair share of wacko religious groups, as well as all the crazy Facebook posts about an apocalypse just around the corner. They were always disproven, though. It seemed like there was always someone claiming the end of the world was going to happen on a specific day, and then the day would come and go with the world completely unchanged. Granted, this did feel different, and unlike all those doomsday warnings. But there'd been nothing to indicate things were about to get turned upside down last night. It had just happened. The fact that Malachi's family was embracing it almost felt stranger than the event itself. Malachi simply looked at her, however.
his eyes not nearly as bright and full of life as they'd been the day before when he'd come to meet her. "I believe my father," he said firmly.
"Okay," she murmured.
They continued walking in relative silence until they found themselves near the gas station where the man had been killed last night. Savannah couldn't help but stare at the scene, suddenly afraid to even pass it by.
"We need to keep going," Jim said in a soft voice, he and the rest of the group having overtaken the two teens on the road.
Malachi took her hand. "I'll be with you." She nodded, walking behind two of the men that were a part of the group. Soon enough, the band of revivalists were past the dreaded gas station that looked unchanged from the night before, heading on down the middle of the road through town and passing the creamery as they walked around a few cars stalled in the road. It felt like she was walking through a ghost town. Everything had gone completely still and quiet. If there were people around, they were staying hidden. When they were able to leave the town behind, she let out her breath and gripped Malachi's hand tighter in a quick thank you. Soon they were at the head of the group again, her RV feeling within reach.
"Up there!"
she called out as soon as she saw the fifth wheel in the distance.
"Be careful," Jim advised her.
She had to fight the urge to run toward her home on wheels.
"We can cut through the pasture,"
she hollered, easily sliding between the two strings of barbed wire that were stretched along the roadway to keep the horses in. Malachi kept her hand in his, and the group walked through the pasture behind them. Savannah's eyes scanned the area, her heart sinking. She should have known it when he hadn't come running to greet her, but she'd put off accepting it.
"He's not here," she whispered, slowing her walk as she reached the RV and looked around for her father's truck.
"How do you know?" Malachi asked. "His truck isn't here," she said, willing herself not to cry. "Where was he?"
"It could have stalled, like the others," Malachi offered.
The small group approached the trailer with Savannah in the lead. She tried to open the door, only to find it locked. Trying to tell herself that that meant he was still sleeping inside, she reached into her pocket and pulled out her key, fumbling with the lock before finally flinging the door open.
"Dad?"
she called out, knowing he wasn't going to answer.
"Maybe he's looking for you," Malachi suggested, when it became apparent he wasn't there.
"Oh, he's going to be so mad," she groaned, going inside the trailer to make absolutely sure he wasn't inside. Malachi and his family waited outside while she searched the small space, looking for a note or any signs he'd been there at all since they'd stepped outside together the night before.
"Could he be at the house?" Malachi offered, when she stood in the doorway of the trailer, her spirit crushed. "Yes, let's go find him."
The group started toward the sprawling farmhouse that had been built at the turn of the century and added on to over the decades. Savannah scanned the area as they approached, noticing the barn doors were wide open. That wasn't normal.
"Hold up," Jim called out.
Savannah stopped walking, turning to look at Malachi's father. He was staring towards the carport, where she could see a body lying on the ground. Her first thought was that it was her father lying there, and she couldn't move. Her voice got lost somewhere in the giant lump lodged in her throat.
"Stay here and let my dad check," Malachi said, moving to stand in front of her, blocking her view of the body lying next to a tractor.
She blinked, and she thought she nodded, but she couldn't be positive. Ignoring Malachi's impulse to protect her, she stepped to the side, watching Malachi's father. It felt like an eternity as Jim walked up to the man,
squatted beside him, and reached out to check for a pulse. Jim took a few more seconds before standing and coming towards where she and his son stood. She knew she was holding her breath, but couldn't seem to force her lungs to expand. Jim's face told her it was bad. His lips were pressed into a thin line, his eyes sad and overly gentle. "How old is your father?" Jim asked her. "What?" She hadn't expected that. 44? She said, a question mark on the end of her word. A sigh left the man's throat, and a look of relief crossed his face. "It's not your father," Jim said confidently.
"It's not?"
she squeaked. "No, the man over there is much older. I'd say in his late 60s.
"Oh,"
she said weakly. The fact that it wasn't her father was a relief. But to think.
"Who is it?" Malachi asked.
"The farmer. Bob Little," she said quietly. Malachi's mother moved to hug Jim.
"What happened?"
she asked. "I'm afraid he was shot," he replied. Savannah wilted, leaning against Malachi for support. Then she turned around to look at the barn, realization dawning, as she started moving towards the building.
"Where are you going?" Malachi asked. "The horses!"
she cried out, picking up her speed. She burst into the barn, her heart sinking as she realized her fear had been correct. Staring at the empty stalls, the doors all left open, she could only shake her head.
"Where are they?" Malachi asked from behind her.
"Gone. They're all gone." There was a silence in the barn as they all processed what had happened. The lingering scent of horses and manure hung thick in the air. Straw lay scattered about the floor in front of each of the empty stalls.
"Someone stole the horses," Jim said, stating the obvious. "In these times, they're going to be valuable enough that people will kill for them."
"I'm sorry," Savannah said, looking back at Tanya, and then Jim.
Jim reached out to grab her hand, holding it between his and looking her in the eye. "This isn't your fault. This is all God's plan. We have to accept it. We can't know what our future holds, but God does. We'll walk."
Moses walked. Jesus walked. His followers walked for hundreds of miles. We can walk.
Savannah had no idea how the man could be so calm, so easy, but was glad he wasn't as devastated as she was. He almost sounded excited about his long journey. The man could be so normal one second, and then the next he said or did something that triggered her defenses.
"I'm so sorry. I had hoped to talk Mr. Little into giving you a couple horses."
Jim smiled. "We're in good health. God will provide. We should get going while the weather holds."
"Right now?"
Savannah gasped. "There is nothing holding us here. The sooner we get home, the better." Before she could think what to say, Malachi grabbed her hand.
"Come with us," he suggested.
"I can't. My dad..."